Then we'll come to order. Just recently, we don't have a quorum yet, but we're going to start anyway because our first presenter has a very busy schedule and will only be with us for 2 or 3 minutes, and so we have to hurry along. Actually, for a while, but not long. So the first bill is House File 923, Representative Hobart, Land Management Bill. And the motion is that I'll have to move this along once Representative Hobart is on her way. I will move House File 923 be recommended to pass, and it's going to be amended as amended and referred to civil law. So Representative Hobart, would you like to make your presentation, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. When we get a quorum, we have the A1 amendment to get the bill in the shape in which I'd like to discuss it. And this was a request by Keith Carlson. My understanding is this amendment will take away his concerns. And as far as I know, there's nobody here to testify in opposition to the bill. I haven't heard any opposition to the bill. This would be called the MnDOT's Land Management Bill. There's a number of issues. I'll go over them very briefly. I'm not an attorney. And fair warning, I'm sure that there's certain sections of this bill that when it gets to civil law will be dissected and digested. And so I'll try and spend most of my time here today with the transportation policy issues with the focus of this committee. The first section has to do with appraisal data that's collected in the course of the negotiation between MnDOT and a property owner and determining when particular appraisal information will become public. Section 2 also relates to that. Section 3 is a turn back, and the parties have agreed to it. That shouldn't be controversial at all. Section 4 is a transportation policy matter that relates to if MnDOT sells surplus land, that it's able to retain that those proceeds rather than having them go back to the general fund, and that by doing that they'll be able to cover the cost of the sale, etc. Section 5 has to do with when they take parcels of property, if they don't need the whole parcel, what happens to the remnants, and Ms. Parker will explain that more in a minute. Section 6, 7, and 8 are part of a bill that to my best of my knowledge, I think this is the third time I've carried this language. It's never been controversial, but it addresses the issue of when MnDOT is working with right-of-way acquisitions and easements with townhome associations, states, rather than having to serve every single parcel or homeowner within an association. They can deal just with the association's governance body. And Section 9 are two additional turnbacks that have been approved by all parties. And with that, I'd like Ms. Parker to go into a little more detail on the Sections 1, 2, and 4, and 5 of the bill.
Ms. Parker.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Betsy Parker from MnDOT. Section 1 of the bill amends the Government Data Practices Act, and it changes the law by making the appraisals that the department does available only to the landowner until the appraisal becomes public as a result of being submitted in a condemnation case or court proceeding, or when the landowner and the department reach an agreement about the price of the property. After that point, all the appraisals become available to the public.
Ms. Parker, I'm going to interrupt because we have a quorum now. As a matter of fact, if it's all right, I think Representative Holberg would like to move the amendment H09-23-A1. Would that be in proper form?
Mr. Chair, if I may, maybe we should move the bill before the committee and then amend it, if that would be your pleasure.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move approval of House File 923 and to be recommended to pass and referred to civil law.
That's what we were talking about. Okay.
That being said, if I might move the A1 amendment to get the bill in the shape, I'd like to discuss it.
We questions about the amendment, which you should have in your packet. Not all in favor of H.O. 923A1 as an amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails and the amendment is adopted.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Please continue on, Ms. Parker.
Mr. Chairman, Section 2 of the bill is another section of the Government Data Practices Act that deals with appraisals, and it requires the department... Oh, no. That's the second... Actually, I'm talking now about the second part of Section 1. Conforms to the first part, which says, which describes when the department's appraisals are public, that they have to be given to the landowner, but they don't have to be given to anybody else until after the landowner and the department agree on the appraisal amount or the documents are submitted in court. Section 2 amends a long provision of statute that was first enacted 2 years ago, and it was basically to spell out some of the rights that a landowner has when the department is acquiring their property. And it does, it has a couple specific changes in it that are of interest. It clarifies that the owner that we're referring to is the fee owner or the purchaser of a contract for deed, so that we're not required to provide the appraisal to every person who claims any kind of legal interest, including tenants and renters. But we deal with the fee owner, the person who holds the title to the property. The second thing it does is that it increases from 60 days to 90 days the amount of time that a landowner has to obtain an appraisal of the landowner's property. When we go out and make an offer, we give the landowner a copy of our appraisal, and we also tell the landowner, you have a right to get an appraisal made by your own appraiser, the appraiser of your choice, and the department will pay for that up to $1,500. And this would increase the amount of time they have to get that appraisal to 90 days. It also gives the government agency 30 days to reimburse the landowner for the appraisal after the landowner has the appraisal done and submits the payment information to MnDOT. And then, in addition, it allows the government agency, MnDOT, or a local unit of government, to pay the landowner's appraiser directly instead of requiring the landowner to pay first and then seek reimbursement. And that's something it would be easy for us to do and makes life easier for the landowner. And then it requires that if the landowner has an appraisal performed, it has to be performed in accordance with the Uniform Standards of Professional Appraisal Practice, which are national and state standards that have been adopted by the appraisal industry and prescribe a uniform method for doing appraisals. All of MnDOT's appraisers follow these practices when doing appraisals. And then, finally, it requires the landowner to give us a copy of its appraisal if we are paying for the landowner's appraisal, which seems only fair. And in addition, it provides that if the acquisition is going into condemnation and we have an additional appraisal made, we and the landowner must trade those appraisals or exchange them so that each of us knows what is in the other's appraisal if we intend to use those appraisals in the eminent domain hearing. And that's so that all parties have full knowledge of what's in the other person's appraisal. It helps with negotiating settlements. And then Section 4 has to do with dedication of revenue from the sale of surplus property. MnDOT sometimes has right-of-way that it either no longer needs or that has become extra for some reason, and we don't need to keep it. It's better if we sell it and let it go back into the private ownership and let local governments have the benefit of property taxes from that land. And so when we do have land that becomes surplus, we have a process set out in statute that we have to follow for selling it. Right now, the money that we get from it goes back into the unappropriated balance of the Trunk Highway Fund, and we have no access to that money until the next time a biennial budget is approved by the legislature and money is appropriated to us. This would authorize us to take that money and put it into a separate account, and we could use it to acquire additional right-of-way that we needed or for construction expenses. And this language has been cleared with the governor's office and with the Department of Finance, so there's no concern there about that. And then Section 5 is a rather complicated-looking section called Reconveyance to Former Owners. And this section was amended several years ago and has caused us problems since, and we would like to have it amended again. The easiest way to understand this, I think, is to think of it in terms of an eminent domain proceeding, which is really when it comes into play. If the landowner and MnDOT cannot agree on the value of the land, then we have to put the parcel into condemnation, into a hearing. And oftentimes, when we put that parcel into condemnation, it takes months before there's actually a hearing on it. We often, because of our construction schedule, need to be able to go onto the land before that. And so we file a petition with the court, and we pay an amount representing the value into court, and the court gives us title and possession of the land. During the time between the time when we get title to the land and months later when the court actually holds a hearing, we might have negotiated some settlement with the owner that provides that we will in fact take less. And then in order to not acquire that lesser portion that we're going to give back, we actually have to reconvey title for that strip or that portion back to the landowner because we originally got title through the eminent domain filing. So that's what this is all about. And it provides, in order to protect the landowner, it provides that we can only do this with the consent of the owner or for good cause and with the consent of the court. So a judge would have to agree that it's the appropriate thing to do. And those are probably the... The rest of the bill, as Representative Holberg said, has been passed in the two previous years, and there's no controversy about any of that. The turnback provisions have all passed out of this committee as separate bills and gone to the floor.
Are there any questions or other comments? If not, we probably want to get out of here, right?
Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to renew my motion that House File 923 be recommended to pass and refer to the Committee on Civil Law and Elections.
As amended, right? Yeah. All right. All those in favor of House File 923 as amended, please signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, same sign. House File 923 is... has passed, and we'll be on its way to civil law.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and Committee.
And I think that we will have a motion from Representative Seibert to for the minutes to approve the minutes of February 16th, 2005. Any amendments, corrections, and others for that?
I didn't ask the question.
If not, all those in favor of that, please indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The motion prevails and the minutes for February 16th are approved. And next we have the aviation bill. House File 915 by Representative Beard.
Mr. Chairman.
I will make the motion, House File 915, to recommend the pass and refer to local government. Representative Beard.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. It's nice to be back. This is the this year's version of the Department of Aeronautics housekeeping bill, I suppose we could call it. It has several different sections. If you look at your bill overview, it says 20 different sections. About 9 of those are related to the same issue, so it's not quite as imposing as it looks, but if you allow me, I'll briefly go through it, and when we get to the really technical spot, I'll introduce you to our expert witness from the Department of Aeronautics. Section 1 of the bill deals with repayment of state funds. This provides that if land that was acquired with state funds ceases to be used for aviation purposes, the municipality or government unit receiving those funds must repay the funds, and this is the key word, in proportion to the amount of state contribution for the original acquisition. So if the, in other words, if the state put up $1,000 to help buy a $10,000 airport back in 1972, the municipality will not owe $1,000. They'll owe that ratio, basically one-tenth of the value of whatever the property is appraised at whenever it ceases being an aviation purpose. I believe there's also a, on page 3, this only applies to projects that were acquired after June 1st of 1971. Let's see, the next several sections deal with exemption from aircraft registration. It clarifies that Civil Air Patrol and certain collector aircraft, certain other government aircraft don't have to actually be pay the registration tax. Pretty much everything has to be registered. Also for recreational and business aircraft, currently those of us that register airplanes get a little decal from the state every year. We have to apply in a certain area on an airplane. However, when you're flying around at 200 miles an hour, it's really hard to see that little decal. So it's kind of useless anyhow for enforcement purposes. So the department says they could save several thousand dollars a year if they didn't send out a sticker and just relied on us to register our airplane. Every airplane has an N number, it's called, that's four, five, six digits long and 12 inches high. And it's pretty easy to track enforcement of aircraft registration taxes merely by walking around an airport and copying down the numbers without actually having to look for the little decal. Personally, I think this is an overdue event to happen. There's several other housekeeping items that deal with dealer plates and a repealer down in Section 20 that if you do pass this bill, we would be required to repeal certain sections that deal with the stickers, the decals, the stamps, and the dealer certificates. Sections 13 through 19 deal with official mapping, community plans, comprehensive plans, and land use planning. And for that, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to introduce Mr. Peter Buchan from the Department of Aeronautics, who can give us an overview of those sections.
Welcome to the committee. Mr. Buchan, please identify yourself for the tape.
My name is Peter Buchan. I manage the airport development section for the MnDOT's Office of Aeronautics.
Proceed.
Okay. As Representative Beard described, he kind of hit the high points. The official mapping language is a clarification language. It's already a power that exists for communities. In that language, there's other things that are accepted out to or clarified that they can be used for parks and other purposes. So we added the airports as that. The official mapping gives communities some sections refer to municipal law, others to county law. It gives them the authority to map an area without owning it, and what it does is if someone wants to develop within the confines of the official map, it puts the community or the owner of the airport in this instance on notice so that they have to take action either to proceed with the purchase of that property for airport purposes or to let the person who wants to develop it continue with their development.
For your clarification, members, Mr. Chair, sections 13 through 19 actually start on page 10 of your bill, the bottom of page 10, if you'd like to peruse that, and run through the end of the bill, page 15. Mr. Chairman, it's short and sweet, but that's our presentation. We'd be happy to stand for questions if anyone has any.
I represent the Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Beard. Taking away the registration identification and some of these things here, you say that, you know, long overdue. How does this conform with the Homeland Security Act as far as qualifications for having your plane registered and that everybody knows whereabouts? You know, the fiasco that happened the day after or the day of, and 3-4 days where planes were grounded for an indeterminate amount of time until they were allowed to go back in the air. Does this have any significance, or does Homeland Security play into this at all regarding this situation?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Anderson, and members, I don't think so. A registration certificate or not on September 11, 2001 would have made one whit of difference to the people stealing the airplanes and turning them into missiles of destruction. Every aircraft, besides what we call an N number, which is the number that's assigned to the United States for registering aircraft, it's a C number in Canada, and every country in the world has an internationally agreed upon set of numbers. So any aircraft flying into the United States would be readily identified by that 12-inch high number that's painted on the side of the airplane. In addition to that, every aircraft that flies in this country, anywhere in the world actually, has what's called a builder's plate with the serial number etched into it, riveted somewhere on the fuselage. Again, the decals that the Department of Aeronautics sent out had nothing to do with security and everything to do with tax compliance. And if I remember right, they're about an inch and a half wide and about 3 inches tall. And so if you were using them for some sort of security identification purpose, it'd be pretty much worthless. There's other ways that are already on the airplane of identifying the airplane for security.
Thank you. Do I understand that there still be number of identification on the planes? Did you just say that? But not the little decals.
Mr. Chairman, it's exactly right. If I was to take the little decal off my airplane, if this bill passes, Mr. Buchan wouldn't bother me in the least. If I was to grind the big painted number on the side of my airplane off and fly around, everybody in the state would know at a glance that I was in violation of something or other. So there will still be numbers on the airplanes that will help identify them.
All right. Representative Larson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Beard. Just to be sure that I understand this, the bill has no fiscal impact, is that correct? And that the repeal of fee is just the repeal of the requirement and the fee that it would cost to pay for that requirement, is that right?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Larson, yes. The impact would be minimal, and it would be stickers and adhesive labels that the Aeronautics Department would not have to buy. Now, to be fair, I believe there are some new exemptions. Mm-hmm. Mr. Buchan, are they new or are they just codified for Civil Air Patrol and governmental aircraft that might have a few hundred dollars a year impact on the aeronautics budget? But I'm sure it would be more than offset by the not having the label, the adhesive label fee invoice.
That's correct. The adhesive fee, the adhesive sticker would save about $5,000 plus administrative fees. It's not a substantial impact, but there is some monetary impact.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Comments? President Stiger? No?
Mr. Chairman. You're
waving your pen at me.
Don't be looking too hard for questions. I don't see the difference.
Well, I just want to make sure. I got that twitch over here. I thought he's getting ready. All right. Then let's renew the motion that House File 915 be recommended to pass and refer to local government. All in favor of that motion, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The motion prevails, and the House File 915 will be sent to local government.
Good. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Thank you. The next item on the agenda is a presentation by the co-chairs of the ITASCA Task Force. My understanding is this is a group of business people who decided that we needed to take a close look at our transportation system, and they wanted to examine it and perhaps tell us what they thought about it after they looked at it. So having with us today is Jay Cowles, and I don't know, Cowles, I'm sorry, and Charlie Zelli. And you'll have to introduce yourselves and identify yourselves for the tape, please.
Thank you. Yes, my name is Charles Zelli. I am here with Jay Cowles, and we are both co-chairs of the transportation initiative of the ITASCA project. And we actually wear several hats. I am a business person, and I'm president and CEO of Jefferson Bus Lines, based in Minneapolis, and we are the largest private bus company in Minnesota. Although our routes extend from Winnipeg to Dallas. Jay is in charge of his family office, and which was formerly in the media business, and has several other private companies. But we're really here to talk about the Itasca project initiatives, specifically in transportation. And just as a little background, the Itasca project is a...
Excuse me, Chair. Has this as a series of about six pages been distributed to the group? That would be helpful, perhaps. And I, who has them for us to know? Right.
I'm sorry.
Do we have
we can share this copy.
A packet of those, or do we need to copy?
Our apologies to the committee.
I think while she's making copies, I'll kind of we'll kind of go through our presentation, if that's all right, and kind of explain a little bit about what the Itasca project is and our specific position on transportation, and then answer any questions for you. What the sheet will kind of give you a bullet point kind of outline of some of our comments. But the Itasca project is really a group of 40-plus business leaders, civic leaders, government elected officials, and education leaders from the state of Minnesota. And it came together a couple years ago because it was felt that some of the larger companies, CEOs, leaders were not taking an active enough interest in civic issues for the region. The region primarily was the metropolitan region, but if there are issues like transportation, it really recognized that this truly is a statewide issue. And we have, and you'll see a list of participants, a full range of kind of well-known companies, and but it's really individuals who, although very involved in their own businesses, do care very much about the long-term economic prosperity of our state. So really, the Itasca project initially was a group coming together as a kind of virtual organization. It is not a 501c3. It is not a separate business organization. It is not a charitable organization. It is really a group that gets together to try to get something done on specific projects where, in our opinions, there might be a value added by having those involved as large employers to make kind of make a difference. Transportation is actually one of six initiatives that have been undertaken over the past year. Transportation is the only issue to which the Itasca group is coming to the state capitol. There are other areas of focus in education and business connections with areas where we think study and some knowledge and some business involvement can make a difference. We're actually also blessed with having the help of McKinsey and Company giving us over $1 million of pro bono help. In a case like transportation, it's specifically helpful because McKinsey and Company, with offices around the world, was able to give us some very valuable information about what is happening with different transportation initiatives specifically around the country, both in roads and in transit and in funding alternatives. So the Itasca project has been very engaged in transportation. Over the past year, it has been doing a lot of study. It has had, we've had a lot of our own focus groups. And as it turns out, business leaders and civic leaders not only care about it as for their own businesses, and I can speak as a bus company operator. I'm supposed to know something about transportation. Well, I've learned more and more about the cost of congestion, not just to our buses not being able to get through the metro area, but a Wells Fargo, armed cars that can't get to the ATM machines, to the Anderson Corporation, which has many vendors who can't get through the metropolitan area for their window operation. It is very interesting that Super Value cares very strongly about the cost of congestion to their business. But more importantly, they view the kind of economic prosperity and quality of life of our region is really going to be bottlenecked by some of the unless a proper investment is made in transportation. As I said, Jay and I are both co-chairs of the Transportation Initiative. We have a steering committee, and they may appear in the Capitol, and we meet occasionally to discuss the positions that a task or project participants will take. As I said, we are both co-chairs. We are joined by Jim Humphrey, who is the CEO of Anderson Window Corporation, John Campbell, who is the president of Wells Fargo's Midwest region, Ginny Hubbard Morris, who is the president of KSTP Radio Operations, and Doug Steeman, the president CEO of Northwest Airlines. When you get the packet, you'll see later on the list of other initiatives that a task or project is interested in. And also you'll see the names of participants. You'll see both mayors of Minneapolis and St. Paul, and including the governor. In this particular transportation initiative, I think it's fair to say the governor has recused himself from a task project participation, but is an active part of our group. In addition, Atasca helped set up a very broad-based transportation public engagement campaign called Go Minnesota. You may be hearing ads and may be reading letters, but the Go Minnesota involves Atasca and many other citizens, businesses, and associations. And maybe, Jay, you can fill in the substance from here.
Now that I can hear the rustling of paper, let me help you for a moment. The first page refers to the overview that Charlie just described. And then, of course, the fourth and fifth pages also describe the six Itasca projects that Charlie referred to. And then on that fifth page, a list of the individual participants in Itasca. So I apologize for our sequence being a little counterintuitive, but pages 1, 4, and 5 deal with what Charlie was describing. When our group identified transportation as one of the urgent issues that we felt we needed to see what we could assist with, we first began by consulting a wide variety of advocates and experts here in the state as well as nationally. Charlie referred to the great assistance of McKinsey & Company. We've also been working very closely with MnDOT, with Met Council, Metro Transit Ways. We've listened carefully and evaluated the plans and proposals from leaders on this issue, such as the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, the Transportation Alliance, and others over the years, and in the end have shaped a strategy which is designed to emphasize and remind the public as well as the legislature and the political leadership of the state that in fact there's a wide consensus around 85% of what needs to be done, and that this may well be an issue where there is so much attention on the 15% that people have yet to develop a consensus about, primarily around funding, that the urgency of the 85% that we all agree represents the solution and the dimensions of the problem are not well voiced or well heard. So to that end, we have a two-pronged strategy that we are bringing to the discussion about transportation. If you look on the second and third pages, you'll see a brief description of Go Minnesota. Charlie referred to this. This is a campaign that has been organized in the last 6 months involving a wide variety of groups that you're familiar with, the Association of Minnesota Counties, the League of Minnesota Cities, Transportation Alliance,
the Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy, Transit for Livable Communities, the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, Minnesota Business Partnership, have all aligned themselves around a set of messages which are intended to get the word out and reinforce for the public the fact that this is an issue of tremendous urgency, of dimensions that require a large-scale, comprehensive solution, and by also drawing their attention to solutions that have been realized in other states and other communities, encourage them to imagine that our state could also find its way to a forward-looking, long-term strategic investment in one of the core infrastructure elements that state government can provide. Go Minnesota is very shortly will be taking a much more public role. You'll hear about it in the media. You'll be perhaps, as Charlie said, receiving some communications from the public. But its role is to essentially encourage all proponents of a solution, not any one single solution, to bring the public to bear on getting a successful bill, a successful conclusion out of this particular session this spring. Go Minnesota's website, as you can see, is up and running. We encourage you, of course, to join, sign up, donate, and become a part of what we hope will be a very powerful discussion about the need for a solution on transportation. We also have established a set of principles that we bring for your consideration into the debates here in the House, in the Senate, and with the administration. And they are summarized on the last page in your packet. I would draw your attention to that at this time. The TASCA project concluded after we spoke to so many people with deep experience on this issue, nationally and certainly locally, that what was not needed here at the legislature this spring was another finely tuned plan that would wrestle with all of the other finely tuned plans for dominance as the horse essentially out of the gate. Rather, you have much experience with many fine advocates here in the legislature. There are interests advancing very thoughtful plans, beginning with the governor and his proposal in December, but also the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce's plan, Transportation Alliance's plan, various other groups, and of course the committees themselves, the House and the Senate, are going to be working on their own versions. We felt our job was not to develop somehow a silver bullet or pretend that there is a silver bullet. The reality is you're the decision makers. And we came to feel that what would be most helpful in your circumstance is to bring the political will and the political attention to this issue to encourage the kind of consensus building that will be necessary in order to actually achieve a result and success. Therefore, we stopped short of being overly prescriptive, but rather developed a set of criteria, and I want to go through them very briefly with you here, that we think constitute essential or very important values in any credible solution to the transportation problem that we're faced with over the next 15-year time period. And we divide our principles or the elements that we think are critical into essentially three buckets. First, maximum efficiency and innovation. We need to make sure, and we describe with three bullets, three particular elements that we think ought to be a part of what you'll see in the later points is a long-term, we suggest 15-year investment program in both roads and transit, and that in order to assure ourselves and the public of the greatest efficiency and effectiveness in that spending, that we establish clear, measurable goals for the new spending and tie funding to the achievement of goals, including the possibility that we slow down or stop funding in certain circumstances if we're not achieving the specific results that are called for in this 15-year plan. That we benchmark current operations with an independent audit and provide public biennial performance audits thereafter. And that we target affirmatively significant annual savings over the 15-year term within our current system. We know a lot of hard work has been done in addressing the cost side of current operations, certainly at the Metro Transit and certainly at MnDOT. We think, though, that this is a time when, given the size of the problem, the history of underfunding, and the needs that our population and usage are going to drive in the next 10 or 15 years, that this is an opportunity to raise our heads, look around the country, look for best practices within our own constituencies, and revisit in as serious a way as we can our current operations and procedures so that we realize significant annual additional savings and essentially a greater effectiveness. The second group of bullets that we describe is, as I described in my earlier comment, an aggressive investment program for roads and transit to meet congestion growth head-on and to support continued economic development. This involves new statewide funding for roads and transit of at least $750 million per year for 15 years, and within that, a dedicated allocation to transit of at least $150 million per year. This is a statewide proposal, with 80% of the funding in both those streams tied up front to specific projects, chosen on the basis of system performance and economic development, and allowing 20% to be recognized as needing to remain flexibly allocated depending upon the dynamics of our learning and our what we find to be the case in our market environment as the 15 years unfold. And finally, in regard to the funding solution, we suggest these principles: that we reallocate existing resources before raising new, that we utilize transportation-related sources first, and that we mandate toll and other user fees to equal at least 10% of new road spending. This would meet our standard of an adequate, responsible funding strategy for the necessary investment that we see the state needing to make over the next 15 years, and this through the lens of a group that, as Charlie said, has the long-term interests of the state as its perspective, and is very concerned that absent such a commitment to significant new investment in transportation, that there will be a diminished capacity for not only quality of life and all the dimensions in which transportation affects our quality of life here in the state, but also a decline in the state's capacity to compete and provide the economic infrastructure that it needs for success in the future as we've enjoyed in the past. That takes us through a quick overview of the Itasca project. And I would welcome any questions or comments that the committee would like to make.
Representative Hauser.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for inviting those of the Transportation Finance to your meeting today. I wanted to just get a little bit of clarity about what the words on paper mean, and let me just pull out one line reallocate existing resources before raising new. Does that mean, for our purposes, undedicating the gas tax and license tax, or what specificity there is in this policy?
A general comment first, and I don't duck it. The specificity is that would be an example, but it is not a comment here that's intended to limit. The MBEST, motor vehicle sales tax. It could be allocations of gas tax. It could be, those would be the two primary sources that at this point are could be reallocated to meet this set of standards. But these principles, but the general comment I would make is that you look around the country, every community does it their own particular way, and there's a wide array of solutions that different communities have found. What works right for Minnesota, I think, ultimately is going to be a very difficult negotiation and discussion. We would say consider these principles, but let's allow a variety of solutions to emerge and be debated and discussed that meet them. So it is not a prescriptive comment. There's nothing underneath it.
Representative Hauser.
If I could just follow up then. I think if there was any reaction that some of us had, we were all eagerly awaiting the finish of the ICASA report. The thought that leaders of this level were sitting down and discussing this, that could have provided this real leadership to get us to a different point. Because people sitting around this table can tell you we've been at this point understanding the problem, knowing a dozen directions we could go, but never getting to the next point of a decision. And I think some of us were hoping that somehow those top leaders in business might step out ahead and take us to that next step. And so when I read this, I look really carefully to see if you are giving us some push to move us to beyond where we've been the last half dozen years. Or where you'll go in the next couple of months, where the people listed on this page will go as we get some sort of resolution here. I'm convinced that the business community is in the best position to kind of break a logjam that we've had, but probably with a little more engagement in the process and a little more clear opinion about what you're ready to support. Do you see yourself going there, or
I'll make
yes.
I want to say first, we are very clearly engaged, and our attention on the issue is will not be confined only to espousing this set of principles. But I think our view, and we've been encouraged that this is helpful at this point, to not be overly prescriptive, but focus on the need for building the political will, reinforcing the urgency, reinforcing the 85% that in fact is the common sense that the planners and our leading experts have identified for ourselves. That is the most valuable role we can bring at this point. I think there clearly will be a time when that our group may well need to weigh in on a more specific level.
And these principles do not preclude us from being more specific. As I mentioned, the Itasca Transportation Initiative Steering Committee is actively considering, but at this point feels it's important to keep our entire business group and civic leaders together, understanding options, and we're considering being more specific.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Coles.
Yes.
You say on that same page that Representative Hausman referenced, mandate toll and other user fees to equal at least 10% of new road spending. We don't have the toll road up and running yet, but I wonder what your user fees that you're targeting there for the new roads, new spending that you're talking about.
Mr. Coles.
Thank you. That's a good question. And I don't have a good specific example. Maybe Charlie does.
I think that 10% is an aggressive number to be achieved over time, and that it was based upon models from other congested areas around the country as a realizable revenue number. It wasn't thought of as being something to be achieved in the first year.
Yes, I heard the specific question is being aimed not at the 10%, but at the other uses, as an example, other than toll roads. I think that the word toll, there are different words to describe pricing, user pricing for roadways, and I think that is what's intended to be used by the phrase other uses. The point being that there is a fast-growing body of evidence from around the world as well as nationally about ways in which essentially variable pricing for use of roadways,
user fees
happen, and sometimes they're called tolls and sometimes they're referred to by other terms.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Anderson.
Mr. Coles, in reference on your back page, your Itasca project participant list, and you asterisk about half a dozen or maybe eight or so members that are active working team. How often do you meet, and if you do meet, where, and is it available? Is it open to the public?
Mr. Coles. Or Mr. Zarek.
Okay. It is not open to the public, and we meet weekly, except we didn't meet last week, and there's a group of that were initially very involved in the formation of Itasca project and helped to kind of be a steering for the overall civic initiative. And we usually meet at available spaces. We've been meeting at the McKnight Foundation, which has been supportive with some limited funding for the Itasca project.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Or would you be willing to, as an active committee there, if we wanted you to come in and just share with us some more information, would that be a possibility?
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Representative Beard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Probably Mr. Coles or whoever. Your sixth bullet point on your statement of principles talks about 80% funding tied to upfront specific projects. Over the years, I think the legislature has done a pretty good job of letting MnDOT depoliticize projects, where they stand, how we do it. They've got their own formulas and magic that they work and come out with a 20-year plan. Every once in a while, we monkey with that. The Crosstown Commons would be a good example of politicians building a highway. But you've got an idea here, apparently, to delineate some specific projects. Do you propose to work with that plan? Do you want to throw it all in the blender and mix it up and start again? Or what do you have in mind here for delineating these specific projects? Are coming up with a new list? Will it be outside of MnDOT or with MnDOT? What are you thinking?
We think there are various lists which already exist which would meet this expectation. MnDOT has lists. Metro Transit has schedules and priorities for specific projects. I think it's a matter of identifying which, relative to a budgeted dollar amount, would effectively be the group that would be agreed upon. But we've not attempted to reinvent the work of people who, frankly, have been working on this for a long time. And I think these projects are
are the ones you're familiar with in your previous discussions.
Okay. Representative Hanson.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and I really want to thank you for the work you've done and the whole Go Minnesota effort, and I think it's going to have an impact. And my question is, you know, I had a similar question to Representative Anderson in terms of examples of user fees, but my concern, and I guess the question I want to put to you is, you know, a couple weeks ago, Representative Lincheski and I had, I guess, what could be termed a user fee, the street utility issue. We had a fireworks display here, July 4th. We had July 4th in February. And the reason for that is that that many members in the business community, and there were, you know, a whole long list of opponents, but the Business Partnership and Chamber were among them, you know, really were very concerned. Well, this is a new tax. This is a new tax. We can't have this. And it seems like, you know, there is new spending required, a new tax is required. And I feel there's a disconnect between the good policies that I think by and large you're promoting. And then similar to what Representative Hausman said, then what happens on the ground here at the legislature anytime something is proposed? And I'll be the first to admit that this bill needs work. It wasn't a perfect bill. We're going back to the drawing board. But the broader message was, this is a new tax and we can't have this. It's going to put us out of business. It's going to destroy the business climate. You know, how do you reconcile, you know, some of these same types of policies, user fees, other taxes, et cetera, with the reaction that we invariably get when any of these proposals are actually put out for a public hearing? I mean, you would think the sky was falling. I mean, it was something else. So, advice, comments, thoughts about this. I'm very concerned, and we had a real world example of this a couple weeks ago at this committee.
Well, I would one response would be to say that we're trying to attack that issue indirectly in the Go Minnesota campaign, by really maintaining an ongoing visible dialogue about the dimensions of the transportation problem, about the dimensions of what's required to maintain an adequate transportation system, about the time frame required in system planning and project planning in order to get things accomplished. In a lot of respects, the public is actually ahead of us on this, but they haven't yet fully converted their personal story about transportation and their experience of it and frustrations with it into a call for political action. And I think part of what we need to do is allow people to imagine that there are actually solutions and that they are responsible solutions, and that this is the kind of investment that other communities are taking, and this is not about keeping up with other communities, except insofar as they are recognizing, as we need to recognize, that this is a fundamental public aspect of infrastructure that, if it does not function well enough, it will diminish our prospects for both our economy and for our quality of life here. So part of it is by trying to bring that up and make it more visible. I'm not sure how to respond to the rest of that.
Just one last final maybe point to, you know, I appreciated what you said about dialogue. And, you know, this is probably a minor proposal in light of the larger issues. I mean, it's a simple way for cities to pay for pothole repair, essentially, is what this is. And but yet there didn't seem to be a lot of dialogue. I mean, the people said, well, we're philosophically opposed to this, and therefore there's no middle ground. And whatever you could do, you know, to promote this kind of dialogue is important, because I think, unfortunately, when we come to this, people seem to be able to diagnose this problem, but then when we come to some very specific kinds of solutions, and this is not a fringe proposal, it's brought forward by the League of Cities, urban, rural, suburban, you know, there doesn't seem to be much dialogue. So you know, that's a key point you made, and I would love to see beyond your, you know, excellent, I think, policy analysis to try to bring some parties together to work this through. And, you know, again, the business community's support of North Star and some of these other initiatives has made a difference, and I think you can continue to make a difference, but we see over and over again, this log jam. So I hope we can have that dialogue. Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Representative Reeder.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Carls or Mr. Zelli, either one, I appreciate the fact that business community is involved. Prior to this year, basically, your group has been negative towards us all the time. The chamber has been blasting us when we try to get additional funding for transportation issues, and it's good to see you come around. And as I look at these bullets you got, I'd have to say that we've looked at every one of those every year. They're the same thing. They might be changed a little because we've had commissions and we've had studies. And they're real interesting, and they're goals that we should have. But I hope that you don't think with this committees and the legislature hasn't been doing this, because we've been doing this. But the end result in this is finances, money. That's the answer in all works. And we don't have the problem here, except they are not the problem, the solution. But I look at new statewide funding for roads, $750 million, equivalent to 23 cents per year gas tax. We can't even pass a 1 or 2 cent gas tax. And we're talking for a million for highways and transit, 750. We need more than that. We don't have, as you indicate here, a dedicated source for transit. But yet, that's the problems we have. We can answer these other problems if we get the finances. That's a real problem. And yet, I had assumed that you were going to come in with a bill that maybe addressed some of the financing, but you aren't doing that. Is that correct?
That's correct. At this time.
You're going to give us some psychological support? Is that interesting?
More health support.
More health support. Well, I can't speak for the committee, but definitely I think everybody's been working on this particular solution. Until we address this at how we're going to handle the finances. You know, actually, if you look at just one of the items, target significant annual savings over a 15-year term. This last session, the governor supposedly took savings out, you know, in that big $800 million deal. This session, he's coming back in because the savings that he took were a shift, and he's coming and going to take $60 to $70 million out of the construction budget. I mean, and that's where we run into this every time we get a new group. And that's what's kind of scary to me, because we don't have the answer here. I know everybody's concerned, but basically, I'd have to say we've looked at every one of these issues and looked at them hard every year. And we're just kind of approaching them, kind of dinging them up a little bit. But give us an answer to finances, and we'll take care of the problem, I think, if we can get some help in that area. Because as we look at it, too, gentlemen, the source of revenue that we have now for dedicated funds is flattening out and going to drop. Look what happens this year, and I think with Mr. Zelli, look what's happening with your vehicles. You're going alternate fuels. You're going electric diesel. You're going, I know the bus company that builds them. They're going to even looking at hydrogen. So how are we going to pay for this when our finances are based on that type of fuel revenue, to get revenue on that? Because we don't know how to tax. You want to call it tax? We don't call it taxes anymore, by the way. This year it's all fees. We forgot about that. We don't know how to put a fee on those particular things. And we've looked at it. And again, some states are more aggressive than we are. Oregon and California, diverting. But again, it's going to be a problem for us as we look down the long term. You're looking long term. Here we are, too. But if we don't have a solution within the next couple of years, it's going to get worse because the revenue source is not there.
We understand, and we agree.
Representative Larson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Coles, and Mr. Zelli. I would echo a number of things that Representative Leader has touched on. I look at this list, and it's an impressive list of leaders in our business community, yourselves, and we appreciate your work. I want to start by saying thank you very much. I think that there has been some successes, certainly by the Itasca Project at this point on this issue, by raising the public view of an issue that's very important, and I think is on the minds of people across this region, across this state. And so I think that there were really high expectations and a lot of excitement about this group coming together to make a real statement about where to go over the next couple of decades with our investment in our transportation infrastructure. And I do think that there has been some disappointment that there hasn't been an effort to step out and perhaps detail even some options for tax increases, quite frankly, to be honest about it. We have a problem that's going to require new investment in new taxes to pay for this problem. Or we can decide as a region and a state that we won't address those problems because we're not willing to raise those revenues. I would encourage you as you deliberate that, you know, I think with the fact that you've raised public awareness on an issue that I think people are concerned with already, and that you plan some public relations initiatives down the line, with a baseball analogy, you know, you got a hit, you're on base. I think legislative leaders need you to get to home plate, and what's going to take you there is to step out. I would say like some of the other groups have. I'd take just for example the Chamber of Commerce, who I know had an incredible debate within their organization about whether or not they could propose a tax increase. And I think it was no small feat that they came forward as a membership and said, you know what, we have to raise the tax. And they had an incredible debate about how much it ought to be. That's I think some of the leadership that would be exciting for us to hear is this group coming together and showing another option for how we can get to $750 million or, frankly, over $1 billion a year in investment over 15 or 20 years. And so I compliment you for the work that you've done to this point, but I just encourage you and take it beyond the moral support and give us some really meaty stuff to help to convince the rest of the legislature. Many of the folks around this table are on board. We're the choir. We care about transportation enormously. We've got to convince the rest of the folks that don't want to raise revenue or that aren't perhaps committed to transportation as we are. Mm-hmm. And that kind of taking the kind of public relations authority or gravitas that you bring to this, in using that to show us how as business leaders you believe that raising revenues will help us solve the problem. I think for many years I grew up hearing how it was only Nixon that could get us to China, and the reality is we're going to take the folks who have traditionally opposed tax increases to help us get over the hump here. And so, again, thanks for the work that you've done, and I'd encourage you, and I hope we can work together to try to finish the job and get the home plate.
Representative Hartman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for coming today. Isn't it fun to testify at the legislature? You seem a little hostile to you because I'm thinking because there's not a lot of specifics here in terms of funding, and that is our challenge this year, is coming up with specific ways that are acceptable to the public to fund. But what is, I think, brave that you're setting forth is the idea that we need new statewide funding of at least $750 million per year. You can't get that selling candy bars, and I don't know how you get fees that total $750 million. So I think that you are setting something brave on the table. I wanted to ask if the committee had looked at tolerance for debt service. How much of our transportation budget are we willing to spend in debt service on an annual basis? My understanding is under the plan that the governor has put forth in the year 2018, we would need 47 cents a gallon per tax just to pay for the debt service. And I wonder if there's some sort of rule of thumb that the Itasca project has looked at for maximum tolerance for debt service that you'd be willing to be comfortable with.
You know, specifically, we haven't, again, taken a particular position on debt service. But I will say that if you look at the list, there's a group of what I would refer to as a fiscally responsible, very acutely aware of the point you make. And it's not lost on any of us that we really are saying that additional revenue is required. But we hear your comments, and I'm sympathizing, because, in fact, as this ITASCA group becomes more informed themselves on the nuances of these issues and becomes more committed to the need, it is a way of as civic leaders to help build a consensus. So we're here in the middle of a process, not with the answer, but in the middle of a process to be helpful.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, gentlemen, I too want to thank you for all your hard work, because it is helpful. And I also want to just make sure that we do remember that, you know, in all the years that we had surpluses, unfortunately, we didn't put money into transportation. So that has put us into quite a bind. And now, you know, and the other thing is that we do remember in that we had the $4.5 billion deficit, which was the largest deficit, and we also did have the largest transportation package in history. Of $850 million. So, you know, I think we are on a roll, and like many have said, we, you know, you're talking to the choir here. But, you know, I think people are willing to put some money into it, and I just want to be sure that we do keep the record straight, and that, you know, there things are beginning to be done. So, you know, keep it positive. But thanks again for presenting.
Thank you. Some of us support the governor and plan, some of us don't. What can you say? Any other questions? Any other questions or comments? Representative Leader.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Gentlemen, I appreciate the fact that you're involved and the group is involved. And I don't want to sound negative, but it's really frustrating. We've been looking at this every year, and I'm glad you're involved in it, because you can appreciate what we're trying to do.
We totally appreciate your position, and in fact, if anything, we want to provide more than moral support. We want to help provide some political will, and we understand that that's tough.
Well, thank you for coming in and explaining to us what the ITASCA and that mystery group out there has been doing. Very much appreciate that.
Mr. Chair?
Thank you very much. It's a great honor to appear.
How long has the ITASCA project been in
How long has it been in operation? How long have you been in existence, I have a question.
Formally, the ITASCA project has been in place a year, but it's really been about a two-year process so far. And at the end of this year, we're in the process of reevaluating what happens next.
Okay. Well, thank you again.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. I just have one announcement. Since we're leadership has taken away three of our meeting dates, we're going to have to double up a little bit. And so I think we will let you know what nights, but I think some nights we're going to stay right on through an hour or so to catch up on some bills. So rather than try and meet on a Friday afternoon or Friday morning when folks want to go home, we'll stay at 4:30. That's probably, nobody has committees after this one, I would assume. So we'll certainly will schedule it, you know, ahead of time, but we'll stay an hour or two. All right. With that, seeing no other business coming by the committee, we are standing adjourned.
Committee means